This is SciPod, the podcast of New Scientist magazine.
Welcome to SciPod, the weekly podcast of New Scientist magazine, and your audio guide to the latest news in science and technology. Hello, I'm Bill Oxley. This week on the March 24th edition of SciPod, in the beginning, why a new look at the early universe has some cosmologists feeling positively inflated. Supersize Mimi. Biologists wake up to a new kind of virus that's so big, it's shaking the tree of life. And in the market for a comet probe, NASA's got a deal for you. That plus a little granite, a little smog, and a lot of school kids who can't sit down. We'll get you this week's science news. But first, 1/1,000,000,000th of a second may not seem like much, but if you were around for the birth of our universe and you happened to blink for that brief bit of time, then you probably missed a lot. It was within that narrow window of time just after the Big Bang that our universe suddenly grew from submicroscopic to astronomical size. At least that's the theory. The idea is called inflation, and if it's true, it's what smoothed all the wrinkles out of the early universe and made it the big, empty, and rather uniform-looking universe we know and love today. Last week, scientists working with the WMAP space probe unveiled the best evidence yet for inflation. David Spergel is a theoretical astrophysicist and a member of the WMAP team. This week, Ivan Semenik reached him at his home base at Princeton University.
Dr. Spergel, can you take us back to the first trillionth of a second of the universe? What do cosmologists think was going on at that moment?
During the first trillionth of a second, actually we think during the first 10 to the minus 35 seconds, we think the universe was dominated by not radiation or matter, but by vacuum energy. That there was energy basically associated, false vacuum energy associated with empty space. And this false vacuum energy caused the universe to expand incredibly rapidly. It was undergoing a period of incredibly rapid growth where the size of the universe doubled every 10 to the minus 35 seconds. So during this period, a tiny fraction of tiny volume grew to be the entire visible universe.
And this is the theory, or this is a scenario, I should say, that's come to be known as the inflationary model. How important is inflation to our overall picture of how the universe formed?
It's the mechanism we have for generating the fluctuations that grew to form galaxies. And it's also the way that we understand why the universe is so big and why the geometry of the universe is so close to flat.
Now, the WMAP satellite is able to look at the distant history of the universe, and it's providing you with insight into this inflationary period. But it's not actually looking that far back, is it? Not at inflation, that is. What is the signal that the satellite is measuring?
What we're measuring are fluctuations in the temperature and density of the universe about 400,000 years after the Big Bang. That's when the universe got cold enough that electrons and protons combined to form hydrogen. Once the universe is neutral, the radiation can move freely from then to now.
So what is it in that signal that's telling you that inflation really happened?
So what's nice about looking at that signal is the universe then is very simple. So by looking at the fluctuations then, we can both learn about the initial conditions for the formation of galaxies today and look back in time at the properties of the fluctuations. So we see a couple things. The statistical properties of the fluctuations are Gaussian, which is what the theory predicts. And our recent result showed that the amplitude of fluctuations vary with scale, that the fluctuations are larger on average on large scales, smaller on small scales. It's a small variation with scale. It's a relatively tiny effect. It's about a 4% variation with scale. But we're able to see it now, and that's a rather nice confirmation of the predictions of the inflationary model. Ideas we had before inflation predicted that should be the same on all scales.
I see. So basically the signature of the radiation from the period that came 400,000 years after the Big Bang is essentially matching the prediction that the inflationary scenario gives you for what radiation from that time should look like.
Yeah.
So how much does this swing the balance? Is inflation now unassailable? Are there still other competing explanations?
There's still other competing explanations. One of the most interesting ones is a cyclic universe model that Paul Steinhardt and Neil Turok have advocated. In this model, the universe has undergone a series of cycles, and the fluctuations were generated during the last period of collapse. This model has less support on the community. But more importantly, it's a model that makes different predictions. So the cyclic model predicts that there should be no gravitational waves. The inflationary model predicts there should be gravitational waves. And while we have not detected gravitational waves yet with the WMAP experiment, the predicted level of gravitational wave signal for some inflationary models lies kind of just beyond our current limits.
So now is this something that in time WMAP will be able to get at?
I think this is something where WMAP will be able to start to enter the interesting region of parameters. We'll, you know, if we're lucky, we'll get at it. And it's something that future experiments will be able to make more sensitive measurements. So I think we will enter the promised land, but it's not guaranteed that we'll go far enough to be able to make gravitational wave detection. But the fact that we can now, in a sense, see the land, we're starting to see the levels of sensitivity we need for gravitational waves, suggests that if we don't do it, future experiments will get there.
And of course, while we're speaking about the promised land, I really have to ask you one last question. You've been able with WMAP to infer some of the properties of that first instant after the Big Bang. It's a tremendous achievement. Do you think we'll ever find out anything about what came before the Big Bang?
You know, I don't know. I mean, that's going to require tying together general relativity and quantum mechanics. It's going to require significant theoretical advances. And ever is a long time, but whether we'll get it in our own time, I don't know.
Well, thanks, Dr. Spergel, for sharing the latest with us from the beginning of the universe. It's one of those stories that gets more and more interesting the more we learn.
Thanks.
David Spergel spoke to us from Princeton, New Jersey. You can read more about the WMAP results in this week's edition of New Scientist.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
Now, here is Jeff Davis and Donna Page with this week's science news.
For decades, scientists have puzzled over the question of how Earth gave rise to life as we know it. Now, in a strange new twist, some researchers think that life may have given rise to Earth as we know it. The idea is that ancient microbes provided the necessary ingredients to create Earth's continents. Continents are made of granite, a type of rock which is not common to other planets in our solar system. It's produced when basaltic rock melts and reforms. But a team of geologists at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark argues that basalt must be chemically altered before it can be recycled into granite. And the chemicals needed to do the altering only became available when photosynthesizing microbes appeared in Earth's oceans about 3.8 billion years ago. This is also the time when the oldest continental crust started appearing on Earth. Team members say this is more than coincidence, and that life in the oceans ultimately gave rise to the ground beneath our feet.
With NASA running short of cash for new science missions, scientists are suggesting a new job for the Stardust space probe. Stardust flew past Comet Vilt 2 and discharged a capsule full of comet dust to Earth last January. Now it appears the main Stardust probe, which is still in space, can be redirected towards Comet Tempel 1. That was the target of another mission called Deep Impact, which sent a projectile slamming into Comet Tempel 1 last July, forming a small crater. The hope is that Stardust can reach Tempel 1 by 2010, giving scientists a second look at the crater, now that all the debris from the impact has settled.
Smog is not only bad for the lungs, it's bad for sperm, too. That's the conclusion of a University of Southern California study, which compared changes in the sperm counts of Los Angeles men with changes in air quality. 48 men participated in the study over a two-year period. Researchers tracked air pollution measurements at the zip code where each man lived to estimate the amount of pollution the men were exposed to in the days before they donated sperm. They found that increasing levels of ozone, which forms when sunlight reacts with smoggy air, go hand in hand with decreasing sperm production. Although the decreases were measurable, researchers say they were not enough to affect the fertility of men with normal sperm counts.
And finally, if you want to fight childhood obesity at school, don't let your students sit down. That's the approach encouraged by a team at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. They've created a chairless classroom to encourage school children to move around more. The team recently tried the classroom out on a group of 10 to 12-year-olds from a nearby school. The school children were given motion sensors to wear and vertical workspaces to which they could attach laptops with wireless internet connections. They were also encouraged to walk around while listening to podcasts of their lessons. Early results suggest the children were burning many more calories than average. If the experiment proves a success, it could mean that in the future, many more students will be asked to stand and deliver as a way to keep off the pounds.
We hope you're enjoying this week's edition of SciPod, and we'd love to know what you think of our podcast. If you've got a comment or suggestion, please drop us a line. Just email your feedback to podcasts@newscientist.com. And now, back to our show.
It's called Mimi, and it could represent a completely new branch on the tree of life. That is, if you think it's alive at all. You see, Mimi is a giant virus, and it's not the only one. These days, scientists are discovering a host of bizarre new microbes and trying to understand what they can tell us about the history of life. Science writer Gary Hamilton has been covering the story for New Scientist. We reached him in Seattle.
Gary, a giant virus sounds a bit to me like a creature from a B-movie. Can you start by telling us exactly how giant a giant virus is?
Well, this Mimi virus is sort of circular, and its diameter is about 750 nanometers, which puts it on par with some of the smallest free-living bacteria, but it's actually larger than many bacteria that are parasites. So it's many times larger than the biggest virus that people had known previously, but also bigger than many bacteria.
Wow. And what I find curious about this is that you would think that the bigger something is, the easier it is to find. So how is it that Mimi was discovered, and why haven't we heard about it until now?
Well, the assumption was that viruses were small, and microbiologists actually have set up their search for these organisms based on that assumption. And for example, they use filters that allow viruses below 300 nanometer to pass through, thereby collecting all the bacteria in the filter, assuming that there was no such thing as a large virus, which now everybody's going to have to reconsider what they were collecting, because it's the large viruses obviously would get trapped with those large bacteria.
So given that those techniques would normally screen out the giant viruses, how is Mimi found?
Well, by accident, actually. The story starts way back in 1992 when some researchers were investigating an outbreak of pneumonia in Bradford. And one of the ways that investigators go about trying to track down the source of such an outbreak is to look in water and sources of water, and in particular they look for amoeba, because many of the bacteria that live inside amoeba are the cause of pneumonia. And so a number of different microbes were found in these amoeba at that time, and one of them happened to be Mimi virus, but that wasn't discovered for several years later because it was such a bizarre thing that no one even expected that it could be a virus. So people treated it like a bacteria and tried to do things to it that they would normally do to bacteria, and failed. And because they failed, it was put in a deep freezer for a while. And several years later, it ended up in France, where researchers continued that process, and eventually, not having any luck, one of the scientists decided it was time to look at it under an electron microscope, and that's when he discovered that its outer shell is actually much more like a viral shell than it is like a bacterial shell. So that's when things started getting interesting.
Now, it's larger than a regular virus. Is it different in other ways? Is it more complex, for example? Can it do different things?
Well, it's incredibly more complex based on the number of genes it has. Its genome, I think, it was double the size of the largest virus that had been known to date, although they're starting to find other large viruses as well. But in that vast genome, there are genes that previously had been thought to be involved only in processes associated with cellular life. So and researchers are only beginning now to have a look at exactly what those genes do. And the big question is, what do they do? Because at this moment, they're completely in the dark.
Now, that's really interesting, because if it has these genes, which, as you say, could be related to functions which we normally would associate with cellular life, How did these viruses come by these genes? Does any of this say something about where giant viruses come from?
Well, it certainly raises questions about whether we really understood viruses at all. And in the past, people thought that they sort of viewed them as almost mistakes, sort of snippets of DNA or RNA that escaped from cellular life and then sort of took on a parasitic life of their own, but generally on the outskirts of life. But what they're seeing in Mimi virus is almost like an archaeological ruin of some former life form. And so many people now are starting to suspect that maybe this virus is what's left over from a much more ancient organism that maybe lived perhaps even before cells did.
Boy, that's really tantalizing to think about it. And as you were alluding to earlier, there's this age-old philosophical question about whether viruses can truly be considered alive, because as you say, they were really just considered to be packets or snippets of genetic material. So how do you think this discovery changes that question about whether viruses are really alive?
Well, on the one hand, it's still a virus. It still behaves in the way viruses do, which is it takes over a host and it uses that host's machinery, for the most part, to make its own proteins and to enable it to replicate itself and then get out of the cell again and propagate. But on the other hand, it has, by having genes that are involved in things like DNA repair or the assembly of complex molecules or genes for folding proteins, it's able to participate in these kind of processes in a degree that, you know, would lead some people to think that, well, you know, what is life? And to perhaps question whether our definition of life really is adequate in dealing with these things, because certain bacteria have invaded their hosts and become permanent parasites. So in a sense, they reside in their hosts permanently, and yet they're still considered life forms. So it's an interesting question, and it's one that's a little bit philosophical, but as one researcher told me, how much DNA do you need to have before you're considered a life form?
Right. And what do you think this is telling us about the microworld in general? I mean, how much more is still waiting for us to discover?
The surprising thing is that we know a lot about viruses and bacteria, obviously, but that's from our limited experience with a certain number of these microbes that cause disease. And researchers are only now discovering that there's this vast world of viruses and bacteria as well out there that have not been discovered. And one of the reasons is that you can't grow them in the lab and you can't measure them in any real way. But with advances in technology that enable researchers to read organisms at the DNA level, they're able to sort of scan the environment now and get an idea of what's out there. And that's just beginning, but already researchers are starting to discover that it's a vast and world with tremendous diversity, and things like the Mimi virus, they believe, are just the tip of the iceberg.
Well, Gary, thank you very much for giving us a glimpse into that world. It's an exciting development.
You're welcome.
Gary Hamilton spoke to us from Seattle. His story about giant viruses is featured in this week's issue of New Scientist.
Subscribe to New Scientist magazine, and every week you'll enjoy a comprehensive roundup of the latest science and technology news, along with the listing of the best science jobs from around the world. Subscribe today, and you'll save 40% off our annual price, and get unlimited free access to the entire content of NewScientist.com. To take advantage of this offer, just visit NewScientist.com/2504. That's NewScientist.com/2504 for this week's best ideas delivered right to your door.
Well, that just about wraps up this week's edition of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you can find in the March 25th edition of New Scientist magazine. Also in this week's issue, Celestial Subway, the invisible network that can take you anywhere in the solar system for free. Cluster Power, a new approach that's clearing the way for the quantum computer. And Urban and Unplugged, from Toronto to Taipei, cities are rushing to go wireless.
All this, plus lots more science and technology news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission Control. SciPod transmission concluded.